Om Kataksha Kiranachanta Naman Mohabdiye Namaha Ananta Nanda Krishnaya Jagannamurte. Kataksha Kiranachanta Naman Mohabdiye Namaha Ananta Nanda Krishnaya Jagan Mangala Murtaye. Ahamasmi Sada Pami Kadachinahamapriyaha Brahmaeva Hamathasiddham Sachidananda Lakshanam Mayevo Deti Chidvyoni Jagad Gandharva Patanam Atohan Nakatam Brahma Sarvajnam Sarvakaranam Nasvatar pratyabhijnanat niram shatvan nachanyataha nachashraya vinashan me vinashasya tanashraya.
I'll try to go a little bit slower.
Nashosha plosha visleda chedas chinnapaso mama Satyairapyani lagnyambaha Shastrai kimutakalpitaihi Abharupasya vishwasya Bhanam vasannidhervina Kadachinnavakalpeta Bhachahantena sarvagaha Nahi banad rate sattvam Narate bhanam chito chitaha chit sampedo binadhyasad rate tena hamadvayaha na deho nendriyan chaham na prano na mano na dihi mamata pariraddhatvat akridatvati dandhyaha. Sakshi sarvan vitapreyan aham naham kadachana parinama parejadita paritapai rupaplavat supteham minatrishyante dukadosha pravrittayaha atastas yaiva samsaraha name samsartra sakshinaha Sukta suktin na janati, na sukte swapna jagarau, jagrat swapna sushuti nam, sakshatoham atadrishaha. Vijnana viratis suktihi, tad janma swapna jagarau, tad sakshina katam mesyuhu, nitya jnanasya tetrayaha. Shadvikara vatam veta nirvikaro hamanyata tadvikara anusandhanam sarvatana vakalpate tena tena hirupena jayate liyate muhuhu vikari vastu tasyaisham anusandhatrata kutaha nachasvajan manashamba Thrashtum arhati kaschana Tauhi prak uttara bhava Charama pratamakshanao Naprakashe hamityuktihi Yat prakasha nibandhana Swaprakasham tamatmanam Aprakasha katam sprashet. This is it. Na prakashe aham na prakashe aham na prakashe aham iti uktihi uktir uktihi yet prakasha nibandhana. So na prakashe aham iti uktihi yet prakasha nibandhana swa prakasham tam atmanam aprakashaha katam sprashet. Let's chant it. Na prakashe hamityuktihi Na prakashe hamityuktihi yat prakasha nibandhana yat prakasha nibandhana swaprakasham tamatmanam swaprakasham tamatmanam aprakashat katam sprashet aprakashat katam sprashet. Na prakashe aham iti. This statement means I don't shine, I don't illuminate, I don't shine. Prakasha is in the Atmanepada third person, first person singular. Na prakashe aham. I don't shine, or you can even say I don't know, right? I don't shine, or I don't know. Iti, uktihi. Uktihi is in the nominative singular, a statement like from vach, like vacha or vacha. It's na uktihi. I mean, uktihi. Iti uktihi, this statement. The statement that na prakashe aham. The statement that I don't know. This uktihi, this statement that I don't know or I don't shine. Na prakashe. I don't know anything or I don't shine. Na prakashe aham. Iti. Yet prakasha nibandhana. This statement is bandhana. This bandhana is in the nominative from feminine. Ukti is feminine, so bandhana is feminine, nominative singular. This statement is connected with, has a bandhana, has a connection with prakasha. You know, it is bound. It is bound up with luminosity itself. Like, for instance, if I say I don't know anything, how do I know that I don't know anything? Like, say I say I don't know, or I am just totally ignorant. What if I say that I'm just ignorant? I don't shine. I don't know anything. Now, to be able to say that, that statement itself, that knowledge of my ignorance itself, is dependent upon prakasha. So nibandhana means that connected to, bound up with, prakasha, is bound up with luminosity or with knowing. The statement, I don't know, is bound up, very intimately connected to, tied with prakasha, with knowing, with consciousness. Okay. Everybody see that? So, na prakashe aham iti uktihi, prakasha nibandhana. The statement, I don't know, is tied up with nibandhana. You know, it depends upon prakasha. You can't make that statement without there being knowledge, consciousness.
You brought in a real mouse.
Well, that's all right. She does it all the time. And she should be complimented for that.
That's right.
She's a busy girl.
So many mice in the world.
Yes, she's sending
them on. It's very disappointing to her when she can't get find one. So she has, then she has to play with her pretend mice. So, swaprakasham tam atmanam. Swaprakasham means one's own prakasha, right? One's own luminosity, one's own light, one's own consciousness. Tam that, atmanam, that self, okay? So that self, which is swaprakasham, I say like this, that atma, tam atmanam, an accusative, singular, that self, which is swaprakasha, self-luminous, take like that, that atma, that self, which is self-luminous, aprakasha, nominative, singular, how can aprakasha, what is not luminous, which is inert, aprakasha, katam sprashet, how can, katam means how, sprashet is in the third person potential, singular, katam sprashet, how can that which is not luminous, which is not conscious, touch, affect, touch in any way? How can it touch that self which is self-luminous? How can that which is inert, or which itself is not luminous, how can it affect or touch the one that is self-luminous? Do you see that the swaprakasham, self-luminous, tam atman, that. Tam is that, that self, in the accusative singular. Aprakasha has in the nominative. So katam aprakasha hasprashet. How can what is inert, what is not luminous, which needs that which needs to be illumined, we can say, if it's aprakasha, it's not self-luminous, therefore whatever it is, it has to be illumined. How can that which has itself to be illumined, in order for it to be known, it must be illumined, because it's not self-luminous, it's aprakasha. How can that which is aprakasha, not self-luminous, which itself, which means it requires to be illumined, how can such a thing that is not self-luminous and requires being illumined, how can that touch in any way the self which is self-luminous? What is self-luminous is not dependent on anything to for it to be.
Does the sun fall in that category also?
No, because for the sun to be known, it requires consciousness. We use the sun as an example, because without the sun, the world is not illumined by light, right? But even then, for a blind person, the sun isn't there.
So it's not self-luminous.
It's self-luminous only in relationship to within duality. But in terms of being known, the luminosity of consciousness, of being known, the sun is not known without consciousness. It must be illumined by consciousness in order for it to be known. And so in that way, the sun also is aprakasha. It's not self-luminous in terms of consciousness. Nothing in the creation, in fact, is self-luminous in terms of consciousness. Everything must be illumined by consciousness, except for consciousness itself. The consciousness is self-luminous, but that means that everything within duality, everything within the creation, you know, requires consciousness in order for it to be known, you know. And so the only thing which whose existence is self-established is consciousness. That's an important little phrase. The only thing whose existence, whose sat, whose being, is self-evident, self-established, is consciousness itself. Everything else depends upon consciousness for it to be known. And so therefore, for it to be. Because without consciousness, you know, its existence is not known.
So if the entire universe collapses and there's nothing?
If it goes into unmanifest condition?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Consciousness, it remains the same as we're having now?
Consciousness without the subject-object. The consciousness with which you are remains. It's not touched by the presence or absence of the creation. Dwight, a subject-object relationship within the creation depends upon the creation being here, right? But that subject-object knowledge is dependent upon your mind and your sense organs, which are all objectified, really, and they themselves are not self-luminous, you know? The sense organs depend upon consciousness. The mind depends upon consciousness, even for subject-object relationship within the creation. You see that?
And consciousness is beyond the sense of organs.
Consciousness is the consciousness because of which anything is illumined, including the mind, the sense organs, and then through the mind and sense organs, the creation, or from the sense, even from the standpoint of Ishvara, the whole creation is illumined, right? The whole creation is known because the creation itself is pervaded by sattva. So the whole sattva, rajas, and tamas pervade the entire, each one of the three gunas pervade the entire creation. Sattva is what is responsible for the reflection of consciousness that we call the chirabhasa. That's like the mind stuff. Rajas is responsible for all activity. So rajas is pervasive to everything because there isn't anything as small as you go in terms of nama rupa. There's motion. That's the rajas. So the whole creation is in continual motion. Then the tamas is that which is responsible for holding nama-rupa for name and form, right? And so the whole creation is pervaded by name and form, by activity, and by consciousness from the standpoint of Ishvara. Within the creation, because when we're looking at the total creation, all three gunas are pervasive, Then when we look within the creation, every jiva, right, that every jiva, every living being has physical body, which is tamas, the sense organs and mind, which is sattva, made of sattva. Those are the, which as though reflect chidabhasa, that which reflects consciousness. And then the rajas is all that, the prana, prana apana, the in going out, going breath, the circulatory system, the digestive system, the excretory system, all of these things, that the karmendriyas, all of the things that allow for motion, that's rajas. So in the way that we explain the Vedanta, the Upanishads explain this, I would say describe the universe, the descriptor of the universe, it's the five elements and sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so from the from what we call the samashti, the total manifestation of Maya, that is Ishvara. And so that means that Ishvara is the five element, the whole manifest creation is the manifestation of the five elements, and then pervaded by sattva, rajas, and tamas. If I'm not identified, if consciousness, from the standpoint of within the creation, is not identified with a given part, like a jiva in the creation, then it's identified with a total. Just like you, when you dream, or you have an imagination, sometimes you're not identified. This is from within the imagination. You're not identified with a being within the imagination, right? When you're not identified with a being, in like a jiva within the imagination, then you're just identified with the whole, because the sattva is pervasive. But from the standpoint of a jiva, the jiva will say, "I am a conscious being." The Ishvara will say, "I am a conscious being," but there's no identification with any given part, because of the. But the sattva is pervasive, and so the whole creation, when the creation is there, it is known. When it's in unmanifest condition, from the standpoint of Ishvara, then because there's no ignorance from the standpoint of Ishvara, there's just the creation in unmanifest condition is like nirvikalpa samadhi. The Maya Upadhi is there, right? The Maya is there, but it is in unmanifest condition. From Ishvara's standpoint, because there's no ajnanam and the Maya is still there in unmanifest condition, it would be akin to like a nirvikalpa samadhi. When your mind is not taking on any form, it's just resolved into the self, but it's still there. It's, you know, it's not, it, is it destroyed? It is still there, but it's totally resolved into the self. So Ishvara, when the creation goes into unmanifest condition, it's just Brahman with that Maya Upadhi, which is resolved. When the creation comes, then it's the, what we call the Vikshepa, the projection of the whole Maya, and that's the creation. It's like an infinite vritti, you know, the whole creation, the whole Maya Upadhi is Ishvara, because it's known, the whole thing is known. That's why I would say, you know, the creation, there's no inert creation, there's Ishvara. Ishvara means this whole thing is an infinite manifest knowledge. Just like, remember, if I say, you know, imagine a seascape, that you are drawing upon your knowledge to project that subjective image of a seascape. So say it's infinite manifest knowledge. We don't have infinite manifest unmanifest knowledge. We don't have infinite unmanifest knowledge. If I say, project all the knowledge, you can't do that, right? But that is Ishvara. That's the Maya Upadhi. You know, it's the creation is, the entirety is projected. Infinite manifest knowledge, whereas for you it's finite manifest knowledge. But nevertheless, when you can project it, when you project something, it's coming out of your unmanifest knowledge, or you couldn't project it. Like, what if I ask you to say project, I say project a seascape, imagine a seascape, you can do that. Imagine a forest, you can do that. Imagine a cup, you can do that. Imagine Gagabugai. And all of a sudden the mind goes, what is that? there's nothing attached with that, those sounds. For there's no knowledge around those sounds. And so nothing can will manifest in reference to that.
It seems to me when you have nirvikalpa samadhi, you're aware, there's a certain sense that your awareness. I mean, it's kind of like...
There's no word saying your awareness, you just are awareness. And it's self-evident.
But somehow you're alert to that, right? I mean,
you're alert to it without any subject-object relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. You can talk about it when the mind comes back, but not during.
Right. And if there's ignorance, when it collapses, you don't have that same attention then, right?
I'm not following.
When it becomes unmanifested.
When the creation becomes unmanifested?
Yeah, and if you have ignorance.
It's like deep sleep.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. It's like deep sleep. It's not. Your mind collapses into avyakta, the unmanifest maya.
Which is different if.
It's much different than nirvikalpa samadhi, right?
Yeah.
Because then the mind is awake. It's not going into unmanifest condition. Rather, its subject matter is the self.
Yes.
And that's an awake mind.
Yes.
Okay.
And it goes beyond the senses.
Absolutely. The sense organs are part of maya.
So it's like going behind the mirage.
In a way, yeah. It's recognizing the self. But that self is has to be recognized even here and now with the sense organs. So let's look at this first so we can close this. Again, just to translate, na prakashe aham iti uktihi. The statement that I don't know is prakasha nibandana. It's totally dependent on, connected with consciousness. Right? Because for you to say that requires somebody to know that you don't know. So consciousness illumines whatever statement is there, actually. Any statement, any vritti, any statement depends upon consciousness for that statement to be made. Right? Any type of I statement. And if it's not an I statement, there's really... If it's a statement, it requires consciousness to illumine the statement. So, since any statement or any knowledge of anything requires consciousness to illumine it, therefore, how can that which requires consciousness to be illumined, touch or have any relationship really to the consciousness? How can it stay in the consciousness? How can it relate or interact with the consciousness, the one that illumines it? You see what I mean? There's no way that it can touch. So it says, how can that which is a prakasha, how can that touch the self, oneself, which is swaprakasha, self-luminous? And so that's the thing to understand, even in your own experience between you and your mind and the world. There is no experience which its being requires luminosity to be illumined. Its existence requires, for it to be known, it requires to be illumined. How can any such thing touch the self, which is self-illumined, self-luminous? And so that's what they're saying, like, any emotion you have, the existence of the emotion, that vritti, requires to be illumined in order for it to be known, right? So how can that which itself doesn't have any existence, any being, it can't even be experienced without consciousness, how can it in any way touch the one who is illumining it? So any vritti, any emotion, any thought modification, any experience, all of these experiences require to be illumined in order for them to be known, in order for them to exist. We can say, for them to exist for you, they have to be illumined. They themselves aren't self-luminous, you know, acting upon you. They require being lit up by you in order for them to even be. So therefore, how can those things which are aprakasha, they're not self-luminous, how can they in any way touch your being? The self, which is self-luminous.
You know, but it feels like your being gets touched.
Exactly, but that's why you need to be taught. That feels that way for everybody, because everyone takes themselves to be the mind. And so the conscious being and the mind are conflated as though they're one thing. Right?
We keep identifying with the mind, which is not self-luminous, and this, what is self-luminous, which is what's perceived.
The self-luminosity of yourself is given over to the mind.
Yeah.
And here we're doing a viveka, so that you can recognize that, in fact, all of your experiences themselves require consciousness in order for them to be, in order for them to be known, in order to, for now, take it subjectively, in order for them to even exist for you, they require consciousness. They need to be illumined. They are not self-luminous. They require your consciousness in order for them to even exist for you. Right?
Right.
So how can something which is so dependent itself, doesn't even exist for you unless it's being illumined, how can that thing have anything to do with you? How can it touch you in any way? Yourself, which is self-luminous. Right? Because they're totally dependent for even being known, or for their existence, in a sense, on your light. And your light is the very your very swarupa. Your light is your consciousness. So how can there be any type of touching between conscious, the conscious and the unconscious?
And what about that feeling?
The feeling belongs to the mind, right? And then you identify yourself as the mind. What you have to realize is that the feeling is there, you know, and the feeling belongs to the mind. It's objectified by you. But does the... is the feeling you? Or is the feeling objectified by you? You can be producing lots of feelings that you would rather not have, the mind, because of lack of vairagya. I need this in order to be happy. That produces a lot of agitation. Or, you know, unconscious things that we have to work on that arise from the unconscious because of childhood wounds. You know, where you get overwhelmed by emotions that were really generated, are generated from past experiences and haven't yet been transformed.
Yeah.
You know, so there's those kind of things that, that overwhelm. In fact, those are the are bigger, in a sense, bigger obstacles for us than just simple lack of vairagya. I need this to be happy.
Yeah.
Because it's just that kind of an adult thing. I need this to be happy and I'm not getting it, so I'm sad. Okay. So simple. Then you can bring your knowledge on that and bring your mind
back. Yeah, that one's easy.
It's easier.
Easier.
but it requires bringing your knowledge into bear upon... That's what the whole sadhana is, and karma yoga is all of that. You have to bring your knowledge in, either during or after. Sometimes it's too big. You have to wait for the desire or the delusionary, you know, fit. We find ourselves the delusionary fit to settle down.
Yeah. Wait for the jerkiness to pass.
Wait for it to pass. And then you bring in your knowledge just to help the mind. You know, it's just habitual. It's habitual thinking, habitual feeling. But then when the things that rise from the unconscious, you know, due to childhood trauma, that requires some different steps. It requires doing some inner child work and being with that child, because it's a little child emotions. You don't, the little child's not a jnani. You know, you can't say, don't you have knowledge, you little three-year-old? You know, what's the matter with you?
I've learned so much and you're not listening.
And so that takes some different type of inner child work and relationship and patience to hold these immature child parts in the psyche. You have to deal with them a little bit differently, and all still in the light of your knowledge, because the one who is dealing, the buddhi, that is dealing with those little child parts or the wounded psyche, all is a jnani. It has knowledge. But just like, say you are jnani, you have knowledge, and you have a little three-year-old, and you're saying, honey, don't you remember you're Brahman? You're Brahman. There's no problem. There's no problem here. But it's ridiculous.
They don't listen.
They don't listen. They look at you like you're crazy. Okay. Brahman who? It's a little children, little parts inside. It's not about being Brahman. It's about being loved.
Yeah.
It's about being loved and held and respected, you know, and given an environment, inner environment, where those parts can transform and grow.
Yeah.
And then they'll join you, the adult, later. As those different parts of the psyche that are hurt release their pain just because of of your love and respect and consistency. And those parts are transform in their own time. You have to be patient. And then they join up. What has kept them split off from the adult you is gets released, and they just join up with the conscious mind. And that takes some time and some healing. So this type of inner child worker ways of dealing with the psyche when they're for whatever painful areas are there, that's important.
Do you need great talents to take care of that inner child, or do they just... what happens in that process of caring?
I don't think you need talent to care or to love. You just have to know how to do that. There's my baby in there with her mouse.
It was dead, and I just took it out. I put it in the...
Where?
In the park. I mean, I tossed it over the wall.
She'll get it.
Oh, yeah. Well, now.
That's all right. That's all right. I never do that. I let her take it out.
But you let her
take it. Yeah, she'll take it out herself.
That's okay.
That's fine. Confused.
Yeah. Can I ask a question about verse 10? Mm-hmm. Is it Sutta or Dukkha?
What?
Yeah. I wasn't here.
Oh, you have an old version. Change it to Dukkha.
Oh, thank you.
It's good.
Sutta sounds better.
Yeah. It's, cross out and put... do, and then that Visarga would stay. These have all been corrected on the newer edition. Yeah.
So there's Sukha?
Right, yeah, here. Change it to Dukkha.
Change it to Dukkha?
So, you know what? You can have a lot of confidence being with the teacher that the knowledge will take place because it's the teacher's job. Can you feel that, have that same kind of confidence with the inner child work?
If you do it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it.
You have to do it, and it has to be done in a way that's suitable to you, that works for you.
Everybody's
a little different.
In one of Swamiji's books, he said, you know, if the student doesn't get it, it's the teacher's fault.
Yeah.
But the teacher has to, you know, explain it better. But at the same time, there's also, you know, points about how you need to prepare yourself to understand the knowledge as a student.
Yeah, but you know what? I think what Swamiji means there, and I actually think it's legitimate, actually, that if the student is present, means that when they're sitting in class and with the teacher, they're actually listening. You know, if they're not listening or they don't come to class, their mind isn't available, that's a different thing. But if they're still a mumukshu and they're not able to listen, then there's other sadhanas and things that you do. So that's up to the teacher also to direct in that way. But if the student is there and has the shraddha and is listening, then it's not just shravana manana nididhyasana. So that has to be there, and it has to be taught properly. And the student, if it's taught properly, the student should be able to see that. But there are also, you know, what we call this upayanishta. Upayanishta means the mind has to be ready.
Yeah.
And there can be all kinds of obstructions and things in the mind, different mm-hmm. levels. Those all have to be taught in such a way that the student understands and works on it. Mm-hmm. Now, say the student doesn't want to do that, then eventually they will want to do it.
If they know what's good for them.
You know, it's
so funny.
Because it's in your best interests. Because you kind of understand these two aspects, what we call upayanishta and upayanishta, where upayanishta is the actual transmission of this knowledge, shravana, manana, nididhyasana. You know, the teaching according to the sampradaya, this passing on this knowledge. That's the upayanishta, the commitment to the teaching itself. The upayanishta is the commitment to the means of knowledge, the means the mind. The mind which needs to receive this knowledge.
Yeah.
Right? And that mind can have a lot of obstructions. You know, the obstructions can either be what we call antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. All purity of mind really means, it's kind of a misleading term, but purity of mind means a mind that is able, is steady enough, pain-free enough, you know, pain-free enough, has enough shanti, relative shanti, in order to be able to get this knowledge at the time of teaching and to be able to hold it. That's antakarana shuddhi. Like, see, the teacher will sometimes, will, not sometimes, hopefully create in the class, Swamiji's a master at this, creating momentary antakarana shuddhi for everybody in the class. Mm-hmm. By telling wonderful jokes, or they just get everybody cheerful and laughing and relaxed and happy, and then he'll slip in some knowledge into that mind, that mind that is just totally open. Your heart is just open, your mind is open, because he's kind of created that spell, and then he'll, in that mind that is so peaceful at that time, it's easy to see what's being said.
But he's also so genuine.
It's not a joke.
I've seen him get himself a little bit into trouble. Like one time there was a woman in her 40s or something, and she was doing some classical dance. And he said, you know, he basically said, she's a little too old for it. You know, because the dance is supposed to be done by a young body. So the woman got very offended. I loved how honest and how...
Well, that's not quite what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's relatively horrible.
Go ahead.
But when you talk about, in regards to what you said to what Swamiji said in this book, but what if you have a... I mean, I think it's... You need certain qualification to be a student of Vedanta.
Yeah.
So what if you have a student that is actually not qualified? I mean, do the teachings believe that they... don't show up before they're qualified? Or is it more, you have maybe people in the class which are not qualified, and then how could that be put onto the teacher that the student doesn't have the mind and the qualification?
You know, if say there's the mumukshutvam, the desire for liberation. Say that desire is there. So that's a partial qualification. Everybody has the mumukshutvam to some degree. That means that anybody that comes to this teaching is drawn to it at all, has to have some level of mumukshutvam, unless some friend has brought them, or they come for
force them,
or they come for to see the Swami for something totally different, which is also true. Like they come to see the Swami to get some blessings, or to get some help, or to get some financial help, or whatever. So many reasons they'll come to see the Swami. But say they come as a student. Then some viveka discrimination will be there for everybody, either a little bit, enough to make them a mukshu, or a lot. So that has to be worked with vairagya, a lot of vairagya, dispassion, or a lot. The shama, dhamma, all of the mental qualifications, a little bit or a lot, you know. But if they have to have a certain minimal degree in order to have any interest in this, something has to be there.
So if you have an interest, then you have. If you have an interest, then you have some of these qualifications.
In the Shama Dhamma, one of the most important ones is Shraddha. You know, so say they come to the teacher. They don't have very much Shama or Dhamma. The mind is agitated. It has a lot of emotional problems, all kinds of things. Shraddha is there. Mumukshutvam is there. Right. And then the teacher should be able to work with that student. Mm-hmm. You know, if they've come to the teacher for another reason, you know, either they want a free place to live at the ashram, for instance, they want to be their life to be taken care of because they can't manage. They're not coming for knowledge. They're not a student, really. They're coming for help or some kind of help. That's different.
So there's so you wouldn't call that a student in particular. That would be
they're not a student.
Yeah.
They might come under the guise of student, but that's not what they really want. What they really want is different, some different type of things. But if they really want knowledge and they have Shraddha in the teacher and in the Shastra, and the Shraddha is so important, like what if they come to the teacher and they don't like that teacher? Mm-hmm. Well, their mind isn't in any type of space.
Skeptical. Mm-hmm.
To listen. Mm-hmm. Or say they come and the teacher's teaching Vedanta, they don't want Vedanta, they want Buddhism or they want yoga. They have no interest in Vedanta. That's not going to work. They don't have that. But if they have mumukshutvam and shraddha, you know, then the teacher should be able to help them. It may take a long time. You know.
And then there's the prodigies.
Well, if it takes a long time, that's not the fault of the student, really. I mean, it's the circumstances also, isn't it?
You know, I would never worry about how long it takes. You know, say somebody comes like, I mean, how long does it take for my mind to settle down and work out its problems? I don't know. It takes as long as it takes. You know, but this is the end game. I mean, what difference does it make, really? Like say somebody comes in there to the teacher when they're, you know, 20 or 15 or whatever. They get this knowledge and they're on their way. Mm-hmm. You can say, well, why did he or she get to get knowledge and happy? You know, at such a young age, that doesn't seem fair when here I am, you know, in my 60s and I'm just coming and I've had a whole life of samsara and suffering and everything. And now I come at this late age and my mind's a mess and, you know, I feel like I'm being cheated. No, I have all these various kinds of feelings.
Complexes.
But then you could say, somebody should say, well, that person who came at 20, you know, spent their whole last life doing all that.
Or lives.
You know? Yeah. And then died being unfulfilled. So took a birth and got back with the teacher right away, you know. Mm-hmm. And then finishes it off in this life. Whatever. Yeah. It doesn't really matter.
Like Ramana Maharshi.
He'd been around for a long time.
Yeah, somebody like Ramana Maharshi hardly needed to be taught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Uttama Adhikari, if all the emotional problems are not there and you've had a life of Dharma, you know, and been raised in a kind of a benign and dharmic setting, then your mind is, and your mumukshu, then there's a lot of things you don't have to deal with. You know, but if you've had a birth where there's some problems in the parenting, there's problems in the society, there's a dharma pervasive in the society, then there are problems that have to be dealt with. But we just deal with them. That's what it is. You should deal with them happily, actually.
Yeah.
Because at least you know something more, and you know how to deal with them.
Should you have any kind of fear that they won't resolve before we have your end? Or how should
I don't know. Bhagavan says, because Krishna asked him that, he said, mm-hmm. You know, now this seems clear to me, but I am going out on the battlefield, and I might be swept away and killed before I really have nishta in this.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen if that were to happen to me?
Yeah.
You know, if I'm killed before really I have understood. And so then Krishna says, you know, don't worry. You'll take this up in your next birth. You'll be born into a family of yogis. Depending upon your karma, you'll be born into a family of yogis and take this up at an early age. Or you'll be born to a family of dharmis, you know, so that you can exhaust some of the karmas that you need to exhaust and then be reunited with this knowledge.
So there's no loss there then, right?
You know, there's only loss when you think that this is the first birth, the first and only and last birth.
Oh.
You know, for Hindus,
for Christians,
and Hindus and many people in the East, they don't have this pressure.
Yeah.
Because for them, their whole culture and what they're born into is realizing this is one birth of many. You know, like in the second chapter of the Gita, Bhagavan says, you know, it's like taking another birth. It's like these clothes get old, and so we get rid of these clothes and put on a new dress. That's what it's like. Mm-hmm. One extended life. And so the creation doesn't look at this as a beginning and end.
The one and only.
This is just a little chapter.
Yeah.
You know?
But they're in that culture, they're so attached to their families, to their wives, to their children. There's such a love of between people, even though they believe in reincarnation. But that's usually the attachment. Yeah. Isn't it?
I think that they do maybe have, or used to have, stronger familial bonds.
Yeah.
Than we have now. It's hard to say.
It's strong, that's true. But like that chant.
But their family structure is really important. It's really important to all people, actually. But, it's archetypal for the family bond to be very strong, and that's why when it's not working out, it's excruciating for everybody involved. Okay, let's take a second prayer. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.